This is Red Ice Radio, a beacon of sanity from Northern Europe. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome back, or maybe you're with us for the first time. However and whenever you're listening to this Red Ice Radio program, welcome to everyone listening. Hope you're doing well. Please take a look at the websites RedIceCreations.com and RedIceMembers.com for more radio, stream or download, and listen at your convenience. We feature interviews with authors, researchers, talking about their work, experiences and thoughts on many different topics. We try to offer a mix of interesting and important ideas, disregarding if they happen to fit in any of the brackets of the old, dying, phony, left-right political dialectic system that has been invented by the social engineers to keep you in a state of ignorant infighting. We don't necessarily agree with all our guests, but we value different points of view and we don't veer away just because it might be controversial or that it might sound strange at first. Keep in mind, just because we don't know about it doesn't mean it's not happening. Today, Mark Gaffney is with us. He is an environmentalist, peace activist, and researcher-writer. Over the years, Mark's articles and essays have appeared in numerous journals, magazines, newspapers, and widely over the internet. He is the author of 5 books. Today, he's with us to talk about Black 9/11, money, motive, and technology. Mark presents evidence for insider trading in the days before 9/11 and other crimes of the US financial elite. He also suggests that secret cutting-edge technologies may have been covertly used on September 11th, 2001, such as technology to remotely access and control commercial jetliners. We'll discuss other interesting details, inconsistencies in the official story, and witness reports related to 9/11. Welcome to Red Ice Radio, Mark. Thank you for coming on the program. First of all, we're looking forward to this one. I think it's going to be a very informative and very exciting stuff. So thanks for coming on, Mark.
Very happy to be with you, Henrik.
Excellent. We also want to say thanks to Richard Grove over at tragedyandhope.com, obviously, for helping us to set up this program. And as far as I understand it, you use some of Richard's testimony for some of the material in your new book, Black 9/11, Money, Motive, and Technology. So I'm looking forward to getting into this. We talked with Richard before on the program, and it's a big subject. There's years of research behind this for obvious reason. It's an incredible amount of details. And, you know, in your book, you've looked at the money aspect, obviously, the insider trading, the put options. You've also looked at the motive, who was behind it and for what reason, and then obviously how this was done, the technology. And this is just as the subtitle implies. Maybe there is a way, Mark, you can kind of paint the broad picture for us and for our listeners who might be new to you and to your work and kind of summarize basically what happened on 9/11 as you suggested to, and also what you know in terms of research, Mark.
Well, the deepest question is why. And of course, this was never touched on by any of the official investigations. They just assumed it was a terrorist attack and that nothing more was involved in that. However, when we look at it, 9/11 as a crime, as a possible crime, and a lot of the evidence tends to support this point of view. And I spent several chapters in the book actually analyzing a paper that had been done on this by a researcher by the name of E.P. Heidner, and he had posted this back in 2008. He titled his research Collateral Damage. That was the name of it. It was a 58-page paper with hundreds of footnotes, and he went deeper into this aspect of 9/11 than anyone. And my publisher and I thought that I should take a look at it because no one else had gone there.
Absolutely. And trineday.com, by the way, that's the website for the publisher. They've released a lot of good books on this topic about 9/11 and so much more, of course, and we'll mention them again later on. So the question is where to begin. I think we should begin on the lead up, if you will. I guess this is takes us into the financial trail and where the story basically begins for you and how you began to looking into some of this data and maybe where you found some of this stuff. I guess you've gone into the Freedom of Information Act and dug up some stuff from previous researchers as well. Is that correct, Mark?
That's correct, and I had published an earlier book, The 9/11 Mystery Plane, and some of the threads that I was not able to fully cover in that first book, I went into in more detail in the second book.
Absolutely. So let's talk about the insider trading, how that looks and the nature of this and where the trail has led you. We know that the SEC has been looking into different companies. I think you mentioned another place that about 39 companies overall was on the suspect list, but a lot of these things has been dropped. There's put options in place. Kind of explain this to our listeners who might not be familiar with this. What has been going on here pre-9/11?
Well, the 9/11 Commission completely fumbled the ball in their official investigation of this whole area. They said in their report that the financing of the attack was of no significance. I mean, this is ridiculous. Of course, the money is extremely important, and they did not follow the money trail. Initially, there was a lot of buzz in the media about insider trading because it was believed that the evidence, that the paper trail would lead back to the terrorists. However, when suddenly, after about 3 or 4 weeks after 9/11, all this coverage in the media just dropped. It went away. And when I looked at this, I came to the conclusion after reviewing everything that was available, all the available documentation on it, that the Securities and Exchange Commission, which was doing the official investigation of the insider trading, they actually found that the evidence did not lead back to the terrorists, but it led back to Wall Street. And at that point, they deputized hundreds of people that had been involved in their investigation so that those individuals would be bound by a security oath and would not be able to talk about what, you know, any of this, any of the investigation. And so I concluded that they had basically just tabled the whole thing.
That's just amazing. Marshall McLennan is one of the companies involved in this. I've heard you talk about AIG as well. Is this where the trail leads? Is this, in your opinion, then where the money comes from?
Well, you certainly have to wonder because Marshall McLennan was the exact point of impact of the first plane, American Airlines 11, that hit the North Tower. And Marshall McLennan, it turns out, had the second highest number of put options in the days before 9/11. So that's meaning that someone had insider knowledge that Marshall McLennan's stock was going to take a huge hit on the day of the attack. Someone knew ahead of time. They had to.
How is it that why does not the media talk about this? Why is this happening?
Well, that's an excellent question. I wish I could give you a good answer, but the only answer I can come up with is that the media is largely owned. They're corporate owned now, and they don't want to go into, this. There are whole areas that the U.S. press doesn't cover, and this is one of them.
It's such a big area, and the fact that it's dropped, that ball is dropped in the official, you know, commission, the report, the book. It's just amazing in itself. But then the fact that all these people allegedly then have gone through it and read it and sit there and go through the pages and yet fail to ask the question or continue to try to follow up on these on the claims there.
Well, the 9/11 Commission investigation, you know, followed. That was the that was started in 2000 and. Two, and then they published their report in 2004, and they only spent a couple of paragraphs talking about insider trading, and you know it's just they just basically just whitewashed it.
There is a few other details about this in terms of the hard drive that was taken out in the wreck, the rubble, right? That was found, and there was a German company involved on trying to rescue some of the data on these hard drives. Tell us about that a little bit.
Well, there were some 400 hard drives that were recovered in the World Trade Center rubble pile. It's pretty amazing. After that intense destruction, they were able to, this company, Convar, a German company, was able to recover 100% of the data on these hard drives. They had a proprietary process involving some kind of laser technology. And several of the U.S. telecommunications companies had contracted them to do this work. They didn't, of course, they didn't know what they were going to find initially, but there were two reports in the U.S. press, in Reuters and CNN, in December of 2001 about this recovery effort. And up to that point, they had examined, I think, 38 different hard drives with a whole bunch more scheduled to be examined. And they had found some very strong evidence of unexplained financial transactions totaling hundreds of millions of dollars, and people at the company were wondering, publicly wondering at this, because it looked like there may have been some hanky panky going on there. But suddenly the recovery effort just dropped out of sight, and there was never any mention of this again in the U.S. press. And we really don't have a good explanation why or what happened. But I think you have to wonder if perhaps the initial report may have been accurate.
Do you think this
thing just was tabled also?
Right. Do you think that they avoided to look into it further because maybe of some of the data that was found on the hard drives?
Well, someone probably had reason for this recovery effort to simply stop or go away. And we really don't have a good explanation about what happened. I don't have any contacts in Germany, unfortunately. This would be a fertile ground if someone, a 9/11 investigator over there, wanted to do some follow-up research on this.
Convoy, that was the name, right?
Convar, yes.
Convar, yeah, okay. Very interesting. Okay, let's try to talk about the interface of all these seemingly unconnected areas stick together, because then we have private companies here, right, involved in financial issues tied to 9/11. There seems to be suggestions within government and within CIA, obviously, that there was a need for a new Pearl Harbor. There was strategies of trying to get America into new wars, etc. And then on top of this, you have an interface with the official story of these Muslims, Al-Qaeda, being behind this. What parts of this do we need to throw out to make the picture comprehensible? And what parts do we need to keep in there still? I guess what I'm looking for here, Mark, a little bit is a coherent picture, if you can paint that for us, of how this was pulled off, and obviously referencing the facts that you do have about it. But if there's any blank areas, maybe you can fill those in with what you believe happened, because it's, when you look at it, it seems very complicated from the outside. Like, how was this? How did they pull this off together, and how were these different units in communication with each other, with money, and then the plan to do this, and the people who were allegedly were involved and were on the planes on that day?
Well, Henrik, we're talking about a very complex operation, and I don't pretend to have all the answers here, but
sure,
we certainly we have some places we can start an investigation, and there are some very curious facts about it, places where we can things that stand out and kind of leap out at you, like for example, it appears that that several things went wrong with the plan. One of them was Building 7, which I'm sure many of your listeners know about this already,
sure.
But it was shocking to me to learn how few Americans actually knew about it. I think a poll showed about half of the American people did not even know that a third high-rise building collapsed in New York on 9/11. This one occurred not in the morning, but at 5:20 p.m. later in the day. And this 47-story skyscraper, Building 7, right one block away from the World Trade Center, just dropped into its footprint in about 6 seconds. And this was, people have speculated that this thing was intended to go down earlier, like in the morning, perhaps when the other towers collapsed, and it would have been hidden in the dust cloud. Nobody would have seen it go down, but something might have gone wrong, and they had to drop it later in the day. I mean, it's an obvious controlled demolition. We have good video footage of this thing collapsing into its footprint from several different angles, and it's clear that it drops at free fall speed.
Yeah.
Which is a dead giveaway of a controlled demolition.
Indeed.
And then they cover this up. The footage has never been shown on US TV primetime since 9/11. So a lot of people still don't know about it. And the official investigations, the NIST report, the NIST investigation of the World Trade Center collapse, they dragged their feet about Building 7 for years.
Yeah.
And their main report didn't even talk about it. The 9/11 Commission report doesn't even mention it. In the 500-plus page report doesn't even mention it.
That's amazing. How do they get away with that, you think?
That's a good question, Henry. You know, this would be, it's black humor here. You know, you have to snicker about it, but
yeah, I know.
It's so deadly serious that it's really kind of scary that they could keep something like this quiet or, basically off the radar for so long.
They just do it, and then that's it. That's it.
Yeah. The other example of where the plan appears to have gone wrong was with the fourth plane. That's United Flight 93. This is the one that went down near Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And I have a chapter in my book about this, my new book about this, and I propose an alternative shoot-down scenario because I believe something went wrong here also. You had three planes that flew tight trajectories and hit buildings at high speed. That's very challenging from the standpoint of manually controlling or manually flying a plane into a building. That would have been very difficult for even for an experienced pilot. For a novice pilot, probably impossible, and it's been compared to a rank amateur golfer hitting a hole in one on the first try.
Yeah.
So this is it's just not believable. And something went wrong with that fourth plane. And the Flight 93 was wandering around the countryside in Pennsylvania and then went down near Shanksville. And this whole circumstance of Flight 93 is also fertile ground for continuing research, I think.
Indeed, it was delayed for quite a while before it actually managed to take off. Do you think that something happened during this time?
Well, I think the delay. See, I'm one of the I'm an investigator who believes that the hijackers were really on the planes. A lot of skeptics out there aren't willing to go that far, but I think the evidence does indicate that hijackers were on Flight 93, and by implication. Probably on the other planes as well. But I don't believe that the hijacker pilots, flew the planes into the buildings. In my book, I present two separate lines of evidence that the technology to remotely access and control commercial airliners already existed in 2001. And I suspect that that technology might have been used on 9/11 to fly those planes into the building. So if this is true, then the hijackers were in turn hijacked.
Ah, I see. So
that's a plausible explanation for what happened. Now, I can't prove it, but I think the evidence is I would call it compelling at this point, I think.
So who do you think that they thought that they worked for, or rather, again, I'm looking for that the interface, if you will, there a little bit of they are on the planes, they're meant to do this. Some people have suggested that they were they believed that they were taking part in a training exercise, and if so, if that's what you also believe, Mark, who were they working for at the time?
Well, there were a lot of military exercises underway on 9/11, and I believe that aspect of it could have. The purpose could have been to stand down the NORAD, because I believe that NORAD was stood down. I don't believe NORAD played any direct role in the shoot down at Shanksville. I don't believe that they were directly involved in the operation. I think, but of course, there had to be insiders if this is true. There had to be insiders to make to stand them down. But as for the hijackers, I don't think we really know what they expected was going to happen that morning. And that's one of the really curious questions. You know, I've asked myself that question many times. What did Mohammed Atta really think was supposed to happen? If maybe they thought they were going to fly those planes into the buildings, that's really a stretch, though. I just don't know, Henrik.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question.
It is. Things we don't know about it at this stage. You talk a little bit about Camp David in the beginning of your book as well, possible location for United Flight 93, correct?
That's right. There appears to have been an incident at Camp David. We don't know exactly what, but there were reports in the media of a crash at Camp David, and there seemed to be confusion about whether something was happening at Shanksville or something was happening at Camp David. It wasn't clear which location, you know. But this is another report that just simply went away. There was a retraction issued later, and we never heard anything more about it. But I believe something really did happen at Camp David. We had a witness who claims to have seen a. This is the way I heard the story, that there was a crew of guys on a roof. They were doing some roofing work that morning near Camp David, and there's a community just east of there, a small town. And they looked up and saw a plane, some kind of a mid-air explosion is how it was reported to me. But then this thing just went away. If something happened, they covered it up very thoroughly.
Yeah, and it should. Do you think that this was the potential fourth target that day?
Well, I think it could be connected to the possible shoot down of Flight 93 at Shanksville. There could be a connection because of the way that the chronology occurred. This incident appears to have happened shortly after the crash of Flight 93.
And you were out on the field as well, right? And talked with the main eyewitness that actually saw the plane go down on his farm, correct?
That's correct. I went to Shanksville. I had a really good experience in Shanksville. Everyone I met there was very friendly and open and willing to talk. I spoke with a farmer who lives, Neville Lambert is his name. He's lived there all his life, and his farm is located about a quarter mile from the crash site. And he told me that he was outside shoveling coal that morning and heard this, you know, this roar up above, and he looked up and he saw this plane come down and crash. And he said that you know, it just spread debris, small pieces of debris, all over his farm. So I think this could account for the absence of wreckage at the crash site. There wasn't much, but there was debris scattered over a really wide area. And I've heard this from a couple of other sources, too, who had, they were the first ones to get to the crash site, a couple of locals there that I interviewed. And they told me they jumped in a pickup truck and drove from Indian Lake, which was a couple of miles from the crash site, and got there within 5 to 8 minutes. And even while they were driving, debris was landing in the back of the pickup truck. So I believe that Flight 93 probably exploded in midair. I believe it broke up before it, you know, while it was still maybe a couple thousand feet up. It started to break up, and something breached the fuselage, because we have debris so widely scattered, and one of the debris fields was 8 miles from the crash site.
Oh, wow.
And I don't think you can explain that in terms of the official story, that debris was somehow, you know, blown up or, you know, thrown up from the crash site and drifted there.
So something went wrong here, and again, maybe a decision from somewhere was taken to shoot it out of the sky, basically.
Well, what I speculate that, and this is speculation, and I can't prove it, but I suspect that the plan was to take remotely access and control Flight 93 like the other planes. However, something went wrong, and they were not able to establish control of 93, and therefore the hijacker pilot was in control of 93. but that the perpetrators had to resort to a backup contingency plan to take the plane down because it could not be allowed to, the hijackers could not be allowed to survive. You know, there was a possibility that I believe that part of the official story could well be corrected. It could well be that the passengers did try to storm the cockpit.
Yeah.
And, you know, there have been cases in the past where if a pilot, for example, had a heart attack, that someone, a novice, could be talked down by someone on the ground, an air traffic controller, could, you know, explain how to land a plane. You know, it's possible. This has happened before.
Indeed.
And the hijackers, of course, could not be allowed to survive because of what the story they had to tell. You know, and they would have been interrogated and the truth might have come out. So this plane had to be brought down. It's very interesting, you know, you put together the evidence, all the different elements, and you ask what could possibly explain all this. And we had some very interesting details. For example, in addition to the debris field that I mentioned, which would indicate that an aerial explosion had occurred, there were reports that there was a bomb on the plane. There was a transmission from the cockpit that air traffic controllers heard, and there were a number of phone calls, conversations of passengers that called family members, mentioned a bomb. So that is another possibility that could explain, you know, how the fuselage might have been breached. But I personally don't think that the bomb brought the plane down. Of course, we don't know, but it's an interesting question because there are other anomalous details that point in a different direction and support my contention that there was a contingency or backup plan to take down Flight 93. We had a witness right near the crash site, within a half mile of the crash site, who saw what appears to have been a drone, some kind of a unmanned aerial vehicle that was very low, like 40 or 50 feet off the ground. And this sighting occurred before the crash, which is very strange, because there should not have been any plane, any craft like that in the area. And there was another key fact. We had unexplained power outages in the vicinity of the crash site, right around Shanksville, local power outages that were never explained. And one of the reasons I went to Shanksville was to try to investigate these, and it did not take me long to confirm them, that they really happened. I met local people who told me, yes, that they were watching the coverage of New York, and the TV went blank just before the crash. Another woman was on the phone talking, and her phone went dead. So I believe there was a power outage there locally, and also we know from the radar data that the transponder for Flight 93 came back on just before the crash, which is very strange. Earlier in the flight, the transponder had gone off, and it makes absolutely no sense from the standpoint of the hijackers that this would have come back on.
What do you think could explain this blackout here? Is this a part of the takedown of the plane or technology? What do you think?
You know, Hendrik, it could be evidence of some kind of electrical malfunction on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what I suspect. You put it all together, and you have a possible attack platform in the area in the form of a drone. And we know that the U.S. military had high-powered microwave technology had come of age before 9/11. They had this, and this would be like a directed energy weapon. And it would explain all the facts.
Yeah, interesting.
So that is, I think, you have to consider it as a possibility.
Now, let's for a moment then go back to the other planes, and certainly there's more to talk about here, and we'll get to it. But the technology on the other planes, GPS aircraft, autopilot systems, something like that, that was guiding basically the planes towards the buildings, correct?
Well, I'm not stating, you know, that it happened like that. What I am saying is the technology to do that existed in 2001.
Right. Yeah.
And I think you have to wonder, because of the extreme difficulty of hitting a building at high speed. Those high speed impacts are very challenging. We had a case where an instructor, a 737 instructor, a Boeing 737 instructor, took a whole class of his. He was training these professional pilots to fly the 737 in a flight simulator, and they were all professional pilots. They had flown other aircraft and had years of experience, but they were learning to fly a 737. He took the whole class into the simulator. This was right after 9/11. And they set the simulator to for the World Trade Center, and they tried to fly this plane into the building. And none of his students were able to do it, even with repeated attempts. He was able to do it after several attempts, but this is kind of illustrates just how difficult this is. Very difficult to fly a commercial airliner into a high-rise building like that at high speed.
Yeah, but we're told that they pulled it off after a couple of lessons down in Florida, right? And they couldn't.
Well, yeah,
even
and it wasn't
pass that.
The simulator they were in wasn't even a 767. It was some other simulator, and they had just a few hours in there. I mean, it's just not believable.
That's right. Okay, so we have a somewhat of a scenario here painted about how this was pulled off. I want to talk about. We need to get into more of the financial aspects of this as well, specifically in Chapter 7, Black Gold. Your book has a paragraph by. Sterling Seagrave on the front cover. We had Sterling with us a while back. We talked well about a lot of things, not you know, specifically pertaining to his work throughout the years and all that. But I wanted to get your take a little bit on this, about a possible financial source for maybe not only this operation, of course, but so much more that has been going on in the world. Maybe you can talk about this and kind of summarize this thesis a little bit for us, Mark.
Well, we need to back up just a bit and kind of mention E.P. Heidner again, because this and your listeners, all they have to do would be to Google collateral damage, and it will bring it up. It's up on the internet. This is a 58-page paper by a researcher named E.P. Heidner, and he looked at 9/11 not as a terrorist attack, but as a potential crime. And he found that there was very strong indication that securities fraud was occurring on 9/11, and that the attacks might have been, the purpose of the attacks might have been to launder a huge amount of money, and possibly in the hundreds of billions of dollars. In fact, the amounts make the actual cash that, according to the 9/11 Commission, $500,000. Was spent by the terrorists themselves to set up, not to organize 9/11. And this, you know, minuscule half million just pales by comparison to the level of possible securities fraud that may have been occurred in the insider trading, and then in the days after 9/11.
Yeah.
So this was the scenario that E.P. Heidner laid out in his paper, Collateral Damage. And I spent several chapters going over this issue, exploring a lot of his sources, and I found there was pretty strong evidence that something like this might have occurred. And I was really shocked when I got deeper into this and realized that there's a lot of evidence for huge slush funds that may have been created by the CIA. One of them that I detail happened as a result of the arms pipeline to Iran that occurred in the 1980s. This was during the it started in the 1980 campaign where Jimmy Carter and Reagan, you know, were running for presidency. And the there's a very strong likelihood that the that William Casey and H.W. Bush cut some kind of a backroom deal with the Iranians to provide arms to them. They had just they were in this you know, existential crisis because of the war that, had started with Saddam Hussein, and they needed arms like right now, immediately, and they were willing to release the hostages, the U.S. embassy hostages, for in return for arms or cash. But the Carter administration didn't want to. They were very reluctant to trade arms for hostages. But there's a very strong likelihood that William Casey and H.W. Bush cut a deal to do this, and that this this explains the you know, of course, they were trying to win that campaign for Reagan and defeat Carter, and sure enough, within minutes of the Reagan's inauguration, the hostages were released, and soon after that, there was a major arms pipeline to Iran, and the Israelis were handling the money transfers, and this went on, I mean, through the 80s.
Sure,
And then finally, it, one aspect of it is a complex story also, but later part of it came to light, and the Iran-Contra scandal, most of it was never told to the public, but part of it did come to light. And we know, because of the testimony by Eri Ben-Menashe, an Israeli whistleblower, he was involved in this operation from the beginning. And he says that there were two major slush funds that were created, one in an Israeli account, another in a CIA account, that totaled close to $1 billion. And later, apparently, this money was handed over to the media mogul, Maxwell. This is a complex story.
I have you curious, but this is how it is, right?
But it appears to have been, it may have gone, ended up in the hands of the Russians, who were, had, you know, staging a coup against Gorbachev. So anyway, I traced some of these threads, some of this evidence, and there's no question that, the CIA had created a big slush fund during Iran-Contra. And then I looked at evidence for an even larger slush fund, and this is where you we get into the black gold and the Japanese gold that was recovered after World War II.
Yeah, Yamashita's gold, and
Yamashita's gold, yes.
Yeah, so much of this, of course, was looted from the rest of the Asian continent, and is believed to ended up in the Philippines eventually. And people have been trying to get to it and get it out, and parts of it has been getting out. It's an amazing story, and there's so much that seems to go back, as you said, Mark, here, to the Iran-Contra affair, or at least maybe here is where one aspect of this very deep, dark underworld begins to kind of show its ugly head to us, and it becomes, I mean, it's a Gordian knot. It's incredibly confusing when you begin to go into that and try to unravel it, and the fact that it has connections in to almost every single scandal that has unfolded consequently after that point, right?
That's right. And two of the most important sources that I relied on were, as I already mentioned, Eri Ben-Menashe, his memoir, Prophets from War, which was really a sleeper, a book, probably one of the most important exposés of the last 30 years. I think it was published in 1992. He actually went before a Senate committee and behind, you know, closed door testimony, and told the senators that he had been present in Paris when H.W. Bush and William Casey went into the conference room to close the deal with the Iranians. Just this was back in October 1980 when this occurred, and of course this has never come out. This testimony was buried. And the other really important source was that amazing book by the Sterling Seagrave and his wife, Gold Warriors. And they that's just an astounding story about the recovery of this huge cache of gold and other loot. There were other precious gems and priceless art treasures that the Japanese had amassed during their long imperial period. It makes the Nazi ripoff in Europe look small by comparison.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, because the Japanese had actually began this the looting of Asia in 1895, and they continued for about a half a century. So they had a lot of time to just loot those countries, and there were about a dozen countries in Asia that were very systematically looted. And this story, you know, it's just so amazing because they, I had never heard anything about it until I, discovered it. This book by the Seagraves, Gold Warriors.
Yeah.
I think it came out in 2002.
And then this started to fit into the picture, and then you try to connect the dots here, obviously, of how that the funds from this now. Do you agree with the Seagraves of how this was? It was under Truman then that this was basically begin to taken out of all the Philippines, correct? And try to be shipped over to the States, maybe not literally, but the fact is that the treasures were taken advantage of, correct?
Well, that's right. And in a nutshell, for your listeners, Truman made a decision to keep this vast cache of gold off the radar screen, keep it secret, and to use it for U.S. geopolitical ends. So what they did is create a huge slush fund off the ledger, and they used it for political purposes over the years. For example, to finance the defeat of the socialist and communist parties in places like Italy in the post-World War era, when there was a Red Scare over there, and the CIA was very concerned that that some of these countries of Europe might go communist or socialist, and they wanted to defeat this, and they may have used the loot also in Africa to support apartheid. And, it just goes on and on.
Yeah.
But, I've just been reading a book about the Bretton Woods Agreement. And apparently, after World War II, there was a major meeting of the minds at Bretton Woods where they set up the monetary system that prevailed for decades after World War II. That was when the U.S. dollar became the world currency, reserve currency. And this whole system apparently broke down in 1971 in part because of a shortage of gold.
Yes, that's right.
And here we have this vast stash of gold that was kept off the books that might have, served to stabilize the whole world monetary system if this gold had been if it had been used properly. So we're talking about a vast amount here. I mean, trillions of dollars worth of gold.
That's right.
So that the world supply of gold, I think it's the official number is 130,000 metric tons, but the true amount is obviously much greater.
Yeah, it's difficult to pin that down, and again, considering how much might be just stashed away in different areas of the world belonging to various people and groups, it's practically impossible to know. Now, I want to try to get a little bit closer to what you believe when it comes to this network that we're talking about, because it's easy to say the CIA, it's easy to say the U.S. military, it's easy to say Wall Street. Do you consider that what we're talking about here is a rogue group within the structure that spans from the military into the intelligence organizations into the corporate structure of the civilian life, if we can call it that? Or how would you begin to pin down of who we're talking about here?
Well, I think we're talking about two different questions here. One of them is, the first question, is there a shadow government? And I believe the answer to that is very definitely yes. I believe that the the U.S. has experienced a series of coup d'etats ever since 1913, the creation of the Federal Reserve. And these bankers working behind the scenes have increased their power with each crisis. And so, yes, I believe there's a shadow government basically running the United States. And they use the government. You know, we have the appearance of democracy, but really the people who control things are off, you know, out of the limelight. They don't like to be in the spotlight.
Sure.
Now, the other question about 9/11, was there a rogue group here that, you know, responsible for this? And this, let's go back to E.P. Heidner's paper again, his Collateral Damage. He theorized that at the time of the Cold War, a group around Bush, H.W. Bush, involving William Casey, undoubtedly, this may have started actually during the Reagan administration. By that point, you know, by the time the Cold War ended, Casey was dead, but, you know, it may have started earlier, but that around 1991, a group around Bush created a huge slush fund to dedicate it for the purpose of ensuring that Russia would never be able to rise again. You know, they would never again be able to challenge the United States. And that he concluded there were four parts to this. There was an attempt to debauch the ruble. There was a possible attempt to stage a coup and overthrow Gorbachev. There was an attempt to steal gold out of the central bank in Russia, and also, and I think this is could be the most important part. There was a campaign and an effort to take control over various sectors of the Russian economy, especially their oil sector, which was one of their most important sources of revenue, maybe the most important. And that in the process of staging this huge operation, this group overstepped a number of laws internationally and U.S. laws, and triggering a number of investigations by various agencies. And these investigations came, after a while, threatened to expose this operation. And that this group around Bush, therefore, made common cause with neoconservatives, other neoconservatives, that wanted to expand U.S. military power worldwide, and staged 9/11 in part to destroy evidence, to launder hundreds of billions of dollars in securities and make this slush fund disappear. Apparently, these securities, according to Heidner, were supposed to come due in September of 2001. So they were going to mature.
Yeah.
And so they had to make those securities disappear. And basically to create mayhem in the securities market so that they could pull this off. And so that was the thesis. Now, when you look at what happened in New York, and the key institution here is the Bank of New York, which is one of the world's most important institutions for transferring funds, the movement of funds, securities. When you look at what happened after 9/11, in the days, weeks after 9/11, you have to wonder, you know, if something might have been going on here.
Oh, for sure.
Because this bank had a record, and, you know, this is well documented. It's not my opinion. The Bank of New York ought to be called the Crime Bank of New York because, and this is one of the oldest banks in the country, founded by Alexander Hamilton. They were involved in a major money laundering operation in the 1990s. Helping to loot Russia. No question, the Bank of New York, and there were executives that pled guilty here, looted at a minimum $10 billion out of Russia. And possibly as much as 22 billion. We don't know the amount, but the senior vice president at the bank that basically supervised this money laundering operation, her husband had been an advisor to Boris Yeltsin and was an associate of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, one of the oligarchs. And this senior vice president was never charged with a crime. She was able to exercise millions in stock options, in fact. They actually, two lesser executives at the bank were actually pled guilty to conspiracy, and they were convicted. But they got their hands slapped, and they had to pay a fine, a small fine, and basically served no jail time. Astounding.
Yeah.
Amazing. And this investigation actually was delayed by the 9/11 attacks. It came to light in 1999 and was ongoing and was delayed by the 9/11 attacks, but then it continued. Now, what is really interesting is that out of that settlement, the Bank of New York agreed to reform itself, you know, and institute new policies so there would be no, you know, to ensure that this wouldn't happen again. And yet, last year, 2011, late last year, the Attorney General of New York filed suit against the Bank of New York for another separate securities fraud operation, which he had, after investigating, confirmed that had been ongoing even at the time of the other investigation. It turns out that the Bank of New York was ripping off U.S. pension funds. They were stealing small amounts of money off each transaction. And that's how they got away with it.
Wow.
Because the amounts were small. But this had been going on for a long time, probably decades. And so the Attorney General of New York was trying to recover a couple of billion dollars. He was limited by the law, statute of limitations law in New York, which prevents him from recovering anything before, there's a 10-year period, 10-year statute of limitations. So the actual amount was estimated to be at least 6 to 10 billion by another investigator, Harry Markopoulos. He was the independent investigator that helped bring down Bernie Madoff. And he has been he's been focusing on the Bank of New York, and estimates that this kind of fraud has been going on for decades.
Yeah, yeah.
And so the amounts are humongous. So here we have a demonstrated record of criminal activity, okay, going back as far as we can see, mm-hmm. continuing after 9/11 right up to the present. So it really makes you wonder about 9/11. And what role the Bank of New York might have played, because it turns out that after 9/11, there was chaos in the securities market. And the morning of 9/11, the stock market never opened. It opens at 9, I believe. So they never opened the stock market, but the securities market opens earlier. So they had already processed around $600 billion in transactions. And it turns out that initially, of course, there was chaos, the communications breakdowns and so on. But the Bank of New York reverted to its backup facilities at Utica, New York, and was able to, you know, within just a matter of days, they were back up and running again. But one of the big problems was failed transactions, what they call fails. Where, you know, securities, they're bought and sold, and the whole system backs up. And it turned out that these fails were concentrated at the Bank of New York. And 1 week alone, they reported $100 billion in failed transactions. So you have to wonder, why was this happening at the Bank of New York, and other big banks did not report, you know, anything like these numbers?
Yeah.
And there was some funny reporting also in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, which appear to appears to, looking back, it appears to be misleading reporting about the actual situation at the Bank of New York. So you wonder, were they reporting what was really going on, or were there planted stories? And so this is an open question, Henry.
Yeah.
This would be another fertile area for continuing investigation, I think. But I think we're never really going to get to the bottom of it without a real audit of the Bank of New York and also the Federal Reserve Bank.
Right, right. Yeah, it's as I said, a Gordian knot. There are conspiracies, within fraud, within looting, and I bet you that there's even multiple levels of. Sometimes we get an idea that it's also very unified on the level of the conspiracy or the shadow government. But I guess that it's actually a lot of different groups kind of fighting to get the upper hand, if you will. And these are some of the components with so many more questions that I have, of course, that I want to talk more with you about in the second hour, Mark.
Yes.
So why don't we take a little break at this point? And obviously, before we do that, we want to make sure to give out all the details where people can find more. I want you to mention the titles that you do have out there. I mean, the 9/11 mystery plane is another one that maybe, if there's time in the second hour, we can talk a little bit about that too, because that's very interesting. But please give out the websites of where people should go if they want to read more and pick up a copy of your books, Mark.
I would encourage your listeners, if they're interested, they can go to my publisher's website. That is trineday.com, T as in Tom, RINEDAY.com. And both of my books are listed there. They can also go to Amazon, but I would encourage people not to go to Amazon. Try to find another way, either through an independent bookstore or through my publisher's site.
Right, very good. Trineday.com, that's the publisher. And then you have your personal website, GnosticSecrets.com, because you have a whole other line of research and interest that has, maybe it's on some level it connects, but seemingly there's no connection at all.
In a sense of getting behind the cover story to what's really going on, in that sense, it relates.
That's right.
This was a book about the Gnostic Secrets of the Nessines, about Gnostic Christianity, the early period of Christianity, and that website is GnosticSecrets.com.
All right, very good, Mark. Stay with us. We'll take a short break at this point. We'll return with more in just a bit.
Once I believed that when love came to me, it would come with rockets, bells, and poetry. But with me, and believe it or not, now there's something groovy and good about
You can acquire a membership at redicemembers.com, get full access to our archives, and listen to more of this program. And of course, every single one going back to 2006, our start. We have videos, films, and much more available for you there as well. We have a few different subscription options, going from 3 months up to 2 years, recurring or non-recurring. Pick the option that suits you and get the full story. In the second segment, we'll discuss the destruction of evidence and the demolition of Building 7. We'll talk more about insider trading, money laundering, slush funds, and amazing coincidences, all connected to 9/11. Later, Mark talks about the future of the US economy, possible war with Iran, and some propositions that he considers could sort out the economy. After this break, we'll continue with Mark Gaffney. Stay with us.